Hello, and welcome to Silver Threads, a weekly program of information on how you can make your senior year shine. I'm Kathy Van Skoik. I recently came across a series of articles from WBUR's On Point program, What It's Like to Live with Early Stage Alzheimer's, which aired December 2017. One portion was originally published in the New York Times in 2016 as A Fraying at the Edges by N.R. Kleinfield. He spent 20 months with one woman in the early stages of the disease as she tried to make sense of it all and live her best life. Jerry Taylor and her husband, Jim, were his courageous subjects. Mr. Kleinfield told them the length of time he would want to spend with them, and they were excited. They both hated the stigma encasing the disease. They hoped they might help shape a new identity for Alzheimer's. Their struggles and what they would also call their adventures as a couple with families, doctors, friends, support groups, and even strangers is eye-opening and encouraging. The original article would require many hours to present in total. I've edited it to be presented over the next three programs, and I begin now with a life-changing diagnosis. It began with what she saw in the bathroom mirror. On a dull morning, Jerry Taylor padded into the shiny bathroom of her Manhattan apartment. She casually checked her reflection in the mirror, doing her daily inventory. Immediately, she stiffened with fright. Huh? What? She didn't recognize herself. She gazed saucer-eyed at her image, thinking, oh, is this what I look like? No, that's not me. Who's that in my mirror? This was in late 2012. She was 69 in her early months of getting familiar with retirement. For some time, she had experienced the sensation of clouds coming over her, mantling thought. There had been a few hiccups at her job. She had been a nurse who climbed the rungs to healthcare executive. Once, she was leading a staff meeting when she had no idea what she was talking about, her mind like a stalled engine that wouldn't turn over. Fortunately, I was the boss, and I just said, "Enough of that. Sally, tell me what you're up to," she would say of the episode. Certain mundane tasks stumped her. She told her husband, Jim Taylor, that the blind in the bedroom was broken. He showed her that she was pulling the wrong cord. Kept happening. Finally, nothing else working, he scribbled on the adjacent wall which cord was which. Then there was the day she got off the subway at 14th Street and 7th Avenue, unable to figure out why she was there. So yes, she had had inklings that something was going wrong with her mind. She held tight to these thoughts. She even hid her suspicions from Mr. Taylor, who chalked up her thinning memory to infirmities of age. I thought she was getting like me, he said. I had been forgetful for 10 years. But to not recognize her own face? To Miss Taylor, this was the drop-dead moment when she had to accept a terrible truth. She wasn't just seeing the twitches of aging, but the early fumes of the disease. She had no further issues with mirrors, but there was no ignoring that something important had happened. She confided her fears to her husband and made an appointment with a neurologist. Before then, I thought I could fake it, she would explain. This convinced me I had to come clean. In November 2012, she saw the neurologist who was treating her migraines. He listened to her symptoms, took blood, gave her the mini mental state examination, a standard cognitive test made up of a set of unremarkable questions and commands. For instance, she was asked to count backward from 100 in intervals of 7. She had to say the phrase, no ifs, ands, or buts, and she was told to pick up a piece of paper, fold it in half, and place it on the floor beside her. He told her 3 common words, said he was going to ask her them in a little bit. He emphasized this by pointing a finger at his head. Remember those words. Well, that's simple. Yet, when he called for them, she knew only one, beach. In her mind, she would go on to associate it with the doctor, thinking of him as Dr. Beach. He gave a diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment, a common precursor to Alzheimer's disease. The first label, put on what she had. Even then, she understood it was the footfall of what would come. Alzheimer's had struck her father, a paternal aunt, and a cousin. She long suspected it would eventually find her. Every 67 seconds, with monotonous cruelty, Alzheimer's takes up residence in another American. Degenerative and incurable, it is democratic in its reach. People live with it about 8 to 10 years on average, though some people last for 20 years. More than 5 million Americans are believed to have it. Two-thirds of them women, and now Ms. Taylor would join them. The disease, with its thundering implications, moves in worsening stages to its ungraspable end. That is the familiar face of Alzheimer's, the withered person with the scrambled mind, marooned in a nursing home, memories sealed away, aspirations for the future discontinued. But there is also the beginning, the waiting period. That was Jerry Taylor, waiting. Right now, she remained energized, in control of her life, the silent attack on her brain not yet in full force. But what about next week, next month, next year? The disease would be there then, and the year after, and forever. It has no easy parts. It nicks away at you. Its progress messy and unpredictable. The beginning is like purgatory, she said one day. It's kind of a grace period. You're waiting for something, something you don't want to come. It's like a before hell purgatory. Ms. Taylor is an effervescent woman with a round face and a froth of swirling hair. Well-spoken and ruminative, she evinces a nimble wit and a droll manner. She is 72. She and her husband, also retired, live near Lincoln Center, and they keep a weekend place in Sherman, Connecticut. In her healthcare career, she had seen Alzheimer's in action. Now, she would live it in high resolution. Those who learn they have the disease often sink into a piercing black grief, try to camouflage their symptoms from a dismissive world as they backpedal from life. Ms. Taylor was wired to absorb adversity, and she pictured Alzheimer's differently, with gumption and defiance, and through a dispassionate, unblinking lens. As she crossed the pitted terrain of Alzheimer's, she would find surprises, disturbing ones and ironic ones, but also uplifting ones. Many days she would not only experience wells of frustration, but also discover wisps of joy. The disease, her new invisible companion, was much larger than she was. She would have to live submerged in its shell. It made her question her purpose and hunt for possibility. Her career was concluded. Mortality was pressing in. Was she simply a woman with Alzheimer's limited to backward glances, or could this be a new beginning? Her husband couldn't adjust, as if he had stumbled into the wrong life. He wouldn't meet her eyes. He drew away sulkily, making her feel disowned. As he would later describe it, I did the usual man thing and went into my cave, became uncommunicative for 2 weeks. I thought, this is not what I signed up for. I had married a nurse to take care of me. How's that for being supportive? 2 years younger than his wife, Mr. Taylor is a lanky, warm-voiced man with a narrow face and a cap of precisely combed snow-white hair. To unfreeze the chill between them, it took a pep talk that put the present in softer perspective. They sat down and Miss Taylor said straight off, "This is something that is going to develop, but it hasn't developed yet." Just saying that helped. Yes, something big had happened. She was what she was, yet they were still alive, still together, with more mileage in their future. So they moved forward in the first days of their ordered lives. Not only was her memory leaving her, many think of Alzheimer's as a memory disease, but its awful mysteries involve more than that. When she gave the doctor examples of her symptoms, he replied, "That's not memory, that's executive function. In effect, you lose the sequence of steps in a process, like a man who begins shaving while neglecting to use shaving cream." She couldn't know the speed of her decline. It is different with everyone until the disease realizes its ultimate purpose. The impact, she had learned, in part, appears determined by the amount of cognitive reserve, the mental capabilities of the brain that accumulate over a lifetime and are related to intelligence and stimulation. She felt she had plenty of that, at least she hoped so. Her doctor put her on Aricept, a drug designed to improve cognitive performance. It seemed to sharpen her thinking, especially in the morning. But she couldn't really gauge how much good it did. There were some side effects. She abandoned drinking when she kept getting nauseated. She was never a big drinker. Fully aware that an earthquake had occurred in her life, she knew this disease was bottomless in its unhappiness if you let it take you there. Yet her belief system was optimism. She never cried. Depression, she knew, would lead her down alleys she did not want to visit and held nothing for her. I can think of 10 things that would get me more upset. My son could get hurt. My sister could. Instead, the disease made her hungry for living. I don't have very typical reactions, she explained. There was actually a sense of relief because of doing something about it. I intellectualized things, so it gave me a false sense of control. I knew I had a tremendous amount of family and friend support. I knew my husband didn't run away from things. She vowed to plunge ahead and accelerate her longtime interest in photography. See friends more. Mr. Taylor had his Friday morning foreign affairs group at the Jewish Community Center, but planned to indulge his interest in acting before he would be conscripted into doing more and more for his wife. He signed up for some acting lessons, and during these things, they felt would make the disease more coherent in their lives. Somehow, they aimed to live the most fulfilling days they could at what seemed the bleakest time possible. His mood improved, too. Mr. Taylor drew up an Alzheimer's to-do list, a way to get started. It was what to tell the kids, when, grandkids, how long to keep two homes, advancing care need, revise will, end-of-life decisions, home care. They began to sort through it. Would they need a two-bedroom apartment for when they required live-in help and to accommodate the fact that some people with Alzheimer's sometimes stay up all night? Should they keep both the apartment and the house? Could they carve out a second bedroom in the L of the living room? They toured an apartment upstairs where that had been done. They decided to stay put and alter the apartment when necessary. They were comfortable financially, but the D's could rapidly devour resources toward the end. Miss Taylor didn't want to be institutionalized, but knew it could happen. In time, they would revise their wills, shielding some assets for their children. What about telling others? Miss Taylor had been seeing a therapist for help decelerating into a jobless life. At one session, she mentioned her Alzheimer's. The therapist said unequivocally, "Tell no one. Friends will fall away from you, stamp you off limits." This got Miss Taylor's hackles up. It was as if she were something illicit about contracting Alzheimer's. Well, she dropped the therapist. The Taylors hated the stealth that encased the disease, how it was treated like an unmentionable cousin. They wanted no part of that. Miss Taylor decided that she would not show herself as some spackled over person. "It was my decision to let the disease be alive in my life," she said. "You don't have to just throw in the towel." She didn't know the order of whom she would tell, nor how to phrase something so shackled with frightful connotations. Your life becomes a script. Alzheimer's, she knew, leaves you its heavy imprint on everyone. "I don't care about what they think of me," she said. To her, Alzheimer's was another fact of human life. But she worried about what the news might do to them, caught as they would be in the disease's undertow. That was her nurse empathy kicking in, and she fretted about how others would view her husband. Would they scratch him off the list for social activities, knowing that, well, with his wife the way she was, they were no longer the same couple, no longer a good fit? She didn't want him wearing the stigma, too. They waited 6 months. She wanted time to try on her new life, acquaint herself with its personality, so she could share the news without an overflow of emotion. She wanted it evident that she was still steering the ship. Then, over the 4th of July weekend in 2013, she told the children, her son from an earlier marriage and Mr. Taylor's two daughters and son from his previous marriage. It was done systematically, child by child, with their spouses or partners. She intentionally told them each separately. "Every kid wants to feel that you have an individual relationship with them," she explained. "If you sit them together, you're treating them like a package of Chiclets. You deny them their individuality. They're going to be reacting to their siblings and their sibling relationships. Dementia has an ugly picture. I wanted each of them to have a chance to react on their own. It was tough news to hear. It was done tidily. They didn't need much detail. It was difficult for her, for she knew she was giving them pain. She postponed informing the grandchildren and moved on to other relatives and close friends, steadily widening the circle. She wasn't going to take out an ad, "Jerry Taylor has Alzheimer's," but she was going to be frank. Her therapist had said, "Tell no one." She was going to tell everyone. Some accepted the news unblinkingly. Others quibbled, the glare of truth too bright for them to stare at. "Are you sure? You don't seem. I didn't notice." Some practically tried to talk her out of it. She was to argue her case, insist that she had something no one wants. One friend got worked up, would call her and say, "I'm just so upset, you must be devastated." "Well, that stung. Thanks for bringing that up," she would think. Then tell herself, yes, there are many layers to this, but it's not all devastating. One thing she had noticed during her confession tour left her with a sunken feeling. Some of her friends showed early symptoms. "They're on the path," she thought. Jerry Taylor was born in Brooklyn and lived there until she was 5, after which her family, the Wilsons, drifted through a sequence of Long Island towns. She had a brother and a sister. She was the middle child. Her father managed a Woolworth store. He had Tourette's syndrome since he was 8, a bad case. He kept it under sufficient control to do his job ably, though not enough that Miss Taylor wanted to have friends over. Yet he was unshakably happy. She caught this happiness. Her relationship with her mother was fraught with difficulties. She was a bank teller and accountant who had a personality disorder. Her mood skittered unpredictably, one moment affectionate, the next belligerent. "It was like, 'Come here, darling, so I can stab you,'" Miss Taylor said. A hello could be humiliating from my mother. She had the idea to become a nurse. She had saved up $300, enough then to enter nursing school. So she took that as the only plausible escape from her mother's tirades. Eventually, her parents divorced and each remarried. They died in their late 70s after having strokes within 3 months of each other. Her father's dementia settled in around age 66 and was advanced when he died. In a nursing home. Miss Taylor's sister lives in upstate New York, her brother in California, neither with signs of the disease. After beginning as a nurse and acquiring a master's degree in public health, Miss Taylor's moved up into administrative positions. She rose to executive vice president at Beth Abraham Health Services and then was an executive vice president at the Jewish Guild for the Blind. One key thing she worked on was establishing hospice and home health care programs to keep nursing home-level older care at home. When she noticed memory issues, she removed herself from direct administration and wrote grants until she turned 65 and retired from the Guild. She spent several more years as a consultant. She worked on adult daycare programs and home health care. The way Jim Taylor entered her life was through their children. This was 23 years ago. Both were living in White Plains. Their sons were in the same Cub Scout den, and she was the den leader. During the summer, both enrolled in zoo camp. Mr. Taylor called her to see about carpooling, and she said that she could drive them. Later, Mr. Taylor asked a mutual friend if Jerry was unattached. She had just separated from her second husband. Mr. Taylor had been divorced for 8 years. He called and asked if she was free on a particular day. She wondered if he wanted to go to Mostly Mozart Festival. Happened to have 2 tickets. They went. He knew from the first date. They got married a year later. Each of Miss Taylor's 2 previous marriages lasted 13 years. Aware of their matching durations, Mr. Taylor used to quip that he was merely the incumbent husband, annually up for re-election until he made it to the 14th year still in office. Others could hardly see it. She knew better. She was slipping, the disease whittling away at her, leaving her less completely who she was. Certain words became irretrievable. Sentences coiled inside her mind and refused to come out. Belongings vanished. Keys, glasses, earrings. She lost things and then forgot what she had lost or that she had even lost them. After returning from a trip, she stowed her suitcase in a closet, still bulging with clothes. Weeks went by. She didn't miss the items. Then she couldn't find her glasses. Well, maybe they were in the suitcase. She unzipped it and discovered all of these clothes wedged in there. A fraying at the edges of her life. "I know the tide is going out on my memory," she would say. She had trouble with elapsed time. It was getting impossible for her to distinguish between the past, the present, and future. Blots of time melded together. She seemed forever in the present, as if her life was one jumbled moment. Breakfast, shower, lunch, dinner, movie, shopping, everything conflated together and happening right now. It was as if, without even trying, she had become Buddhist. "I have no clock in my head anymore," is how she put it. The concept of how long it takes to do something has been lost. When an hour feels like is gone, it's morning, then afternoon, and I think the morning was yesterday. She knitted her brow. "The time thing is the part where I feel most alien from myself and alien from other people. Sometimes I feel like I'm sort of a loose atom bouncing around, like I'm not doing anything because I'm floating from one thing, and then I don't remember that thing that I sometimes did. And you'll say, well, write it down, but then I'll look at the piece of paper and wonder, what is that?" To untangle the confusions in the infrastructure of her life, she claimed small victories, however she could, savoring them. "I've been washing the sheets and towels more often because I'm not sure when I last washed them," she said. "I forget how much food we have. I check more often. I know Jim is monitoring the food much more." Her organizational tool had been her mind, but now her mind was a mess, as if a windstorm had upended its contents. "I always remembered phone numbers, addresses, how much people paid for their house, and I've lost all that." She knew how to live with a good memory. Who knew how to live without one? Her new best friend was her iPhone. She fished it out maybe 20 times a day and scrolled through the blocked-off calendar and notes to herself, the lumber of dates and names that never seemed heavier. Have to be where, when, do what? The caregiving kind organization is housed in one of those muscular office towers that jut up on Lexington Avenue in Midtown Manhattan. It was where people faced with Alzheimer's can go for help. About 15,000 or so a year seek something from it. They make up a sliver of the roughly 250,000 people living in New York who the group thinks have Alzheimer's. Llewellyn Barkin, the chief executive of the group, at the time it was a chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, saw this with her own father. He had some odd symptoms, but, well, they were also odd, and he prompted the family to get what a doctor was then thumbed through a checkbook, often a giveaway. He hadn't balanced it in months. He had written checks for charities that he never supported, like the mouth and foot painting artists. Well, when she mulled over whether the organization had something for her, Jerry Taylor was reluctant to visit. She pictured the place as a resource for those sunk much deeper into the disease's darkening world, that it was too early for her. Still, one sun-smack day in March 2014, she went to have a look. Once she mingled a bit, she knew she had been dead wrong. She was not early. She was right on time. In a city of so many, she knew these people. They were alike, all walking in the shadow of Alzheimer's. "I thought these were my people," she said. "This is where I belong." She dived in and enrolled in some programs. Discover New York, a photography workshop. And she signed on for one of the continuing Memory Works groups that engaged in mind exercises for those in the early stages of Alzheimer's. At first, Miss Taylor was skeptical. She knew all about the memory games that some experts promote to reshape balky minds, yet the research she had read frowned on their effectiveness. Her own feeling was they were annoying and pointless. Yet she gave Memory Works a shot. Surprisingly, she liked it. Liked the companionable people, liked the exercises. She became known as the perky one. The moderator was upfront that the games would not cure them or forestall their decline. They were there to have fun. One of them was a marvelous whistler who entertained them while they waited to begin. So every Thursday at 11, she came, sat among the eight, and participated in the swell of games for an hour and a half. Name words starting with the letter B. Name food starting with the letter M. The best part was not having to mask her shortcomings, audition for acceptance. In the outside world, that was increasingly foreign and fearsome. The pages seemed to turn too fast, and it was a constant struggle to keep up. People say, "What do you mean? There's nothing wrong with you," she would explain, "but I'm always hiding things." Outside, people with Alzheimer's were looked on as broken. In the groups inside these walls, though, everyone had it. Alzheimer's was normal. In memory works, she felt protected, unhampered. One of the others called it a safe place, and that felt right to her. There's nothing like being different with your own people, is how she would put it. More than anything, people with leaky memories came to this sanctuary to find affirmation that they were still a presence in the world, that they were still valid. Miss Taylor found renewed meaning by being among others like herself. As Thursdays swept by, the sessions became amazing. Not the games and whether they did any tangible good, but the chumminess and the vibe among the strangers, all hijacked by a ghastly disease. The retired software developer and the former lawyer and the bridge writer. They egged one another on, joked around. It seemed inconceivable, but Miss Taylor had never belonged to a group that was so much fun. "It's like a party," she would tell others. "Everyone's laughing, and everyone is happy, and they are with people just like them who can't get the words out and can't find the bus pass." Sitting there in bubbly ambience, she would sometimes think, "We shouldn't be this happy." It was as if they were all high on Alzheimer's. Well, we leave Jerry Taylor at the end of part one of Fraying at the Edges, being happy, surprisingly high on Alzheimer's with those who shared her disease in the Memory Works program. In the next segment, she experiences frustration and triumphs, watches her husband play an Alzheimer's patient in a play, shares her news with friends, and learns of a clinical trial in which she might participate. Thanks for listening, and until next week, I'm Kathy Van Skoik. You've been listening to Silver Threads, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. The audio producer for the show is Maureen Rich, and I'm Kathy Van Skoik. I hope you will join me again next week for more information and updates for making the best of your silver years. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.